KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's second forum hour, Washington Post Pulitzer Prize-winning senior Pentagon correspondent Tom Ricks will be joining us to talk about his new book on the Iraq invasion and occupation. It's called Fiasco, and he joins us for an hour on what he calls the American military adventure in Iraq after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Forum listeners may recall that we had on Chief New York Times military correspondent Michael Gordon, the co-author with General Bernard Traynor of Cobra II, the inside story of the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Thomas Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning senior Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post, focuses on how we got into Iraq and what went wrong and picks up from where Cobra II stopped at the insurgency and takes us to the present. Based on hundreds of interviews and a review of some 37,000 pages of documents, Fiasco, the American military adventure in Iraq, focuses on the military conduct of the war and the management or mismanagement of the insurgency. Thomas Ricks has covered the U.S. military for The Washington Post since the year 2000 and covered that beat as a Wall Street Journal reporter for 17 years, a member of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams for national reporting, reported on U.S. military activities not only in Iraq, but also in Somalia, Haiti, Kosovo, Macedonia, Kuwait, Turkey, and Afghanistan. And he's also the author of Making the Corps and A Soldier's Duty, and he joins us here in studio. And good to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
And congratulations for getting the number one on the New York Times bestseller list for next Sunday, which I think speaks volumes about the necessity of and the hunger that Americans have to find out the story, such as it is. Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, is giving testimony today on the Hill, and certainly he has come under fire, not enough boots, and going on the cheap. But really, you kind of point the finger at everybody, at the Pentagon, at the military, at Bremer, all sharing in culpability and nobody getting much accountability.
That's right. I don't think you get a mess this big just with the mistakes of two or three people. Absolutely, President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld made serious mistakes, both during the run-up to the war and during the occupation. But to get a mess this big, you really need a systemic breakdown, is the argument at the beginning of the book. I looked at five basic groups: the Bush administration, the CIA and the intelligence community, the media, the military, which I think is an area that really needs to be looked at more, and finally Congress, which is, in this case, the dog that didn't bark. The other institutions were basically sins of commission. Congress's sin has been a sin of omission, a lack of oversight, a lack of accountability.
And that's a failure to really, as you point out, serve its constitutional role.
Yes, and sort of kind of ineptly in my own way, I stepped up to the plate and tried to answer the questions that I wish Congress had been asking and getting answers to. Why has the occupation gone the way it has? Was it inevitable? Are resources being spent well, or are they being squandered? And I don't have the power of subpoena. I don't have massive resources. Most of all, I don't have the power of the purse string. But I went out and asked a lot of these questions and looked at a lot of documents and tried to answer as best as possible here and say, here's what happened, here's how it happened, here's why it happened. But I'll never do as good a job as the Congress could do. It's just that I did what I could do.
Well, the Congress really also, as you point out, failed to question the Bush administration. And as much as the Bush administration, with President Bush and Secretary Cheney and Rumsfeld, may be culpable, the military errors are also what come out in your book as being so conspicuous and so alarming and dramatic.
And especially worrisome to me because when you don't look at the military errors, then things go wrong. Troops die unnecessarily. Iraqis die unnecessarily, and we don't win. One of the reasons I gave this book its provocative title, Fiasco, was to kind of put up a blinking red light there and say, hey, let's pay attention here. This could be done better. Congress doesn't do this, I think, for two reasons. First, the Republicans don't want to embarrass the administration, and the Democrats really don't know how to ask the questions. I think they've confused supporting the troops with supporting the generals. There's a big difference between the troops and the generals, and in one way to support the troops is to question and criticize the generals. Yet in this war, not a single general has been relieved. Compare that to World War II. At the beginning of World War II, George Marshall was the Army Chief of Staff, relieved over 100 senior officers. Lincoln, during the Civil War, ran through generals looking for someone who could fight and win the war for him. But we have a military that really doesn't want to look at its own leadership lapses and a Congress that isn't forcing the military to do that. And I think it's unfair to the troops.
The generals, as you point out, are out of their element. In fact, one of the generals who has been heralded as one of the great heroic figures of the war, Tommy Frank, comes out perhaps worst of all.
The more I looked at Frank's, the less impressed I was. I came away thinking, after doing these interviews, I want to emphasize this is not a book of my opinions. In fact, I don't believe I appear in the book. It's a look at the best judgment I could find inside and outside the U.S. military. But the judgment on Frank's, yes, is harsh in the book, that he helped write what may be the worst war plan in American history, that his war plan helped create the insurgency, and that he then walked away and retired. And the image that comes to my mind is as if General Eisenhower, in July 1944, a month after D-Day, turned to Omar Bradley and said, "Good luck on your way to Berlin. I'm off to play golf."
Talk about how Franks helped create the insurgency. I mean, that's quite a story, and not one that necessarily many know.
Well, the president, rightly or wrongly, had instructed him to go to Iraq and invade it with the purpose of transforming Iraq and transforming the region. This was this transformational vision the Bush administration had after 9/11 of what they wanted to do in Iraq. Remember, they were going to drain the swamp of the Middle East, they said, and it began there. Yet, Frank's war plan was a war plan that looked more like a coup d'etat for a banana republic, where you zip to the capital and you decapitate the regime and you leave. The original war plan called for us to be down to 30,000 troops by August 2003. In fact, here we are 3 years later, August 2006, and we're at 127,000 troops and growing. So the assumptions on which Frank based his war plan were incorrect, and he didn't have plan B. He spent 80% or 90% of his energies looking at how to get to Baghdad, and very little of his energy on what to do once he got there. And that was the hard problem. There was no question that we were going to get to Baghdad pretty fast. But there was very little serious thought and planning for, okay, what do you do once you get there? And what if your assumptions are wrong? What if we're not greeted as liberators? And that fecklessness in that plan, I think, gave the insurgency valuable time in which to coalesce and grow and then attack.
The other, speaking about going into Baghdad and everything, of course, it comes out in your book that Chalabi was giving U.S. troop movements over all along, I mean, almost from the inception.
One very senior U.S. military intelligence officer looked at me during an interview and said, "Tom, what's the difference between Tommy Franks and the Iranian government?" I said, "I don't know." He said, "The Iranians had a plan for phase four." And I said, "What do you mean by that?" And he said, "Oh, they were on our heels. As we came across southern Iraq in the invasion, they were right behind us. They knew what they wanted to do, and they came in fast. Whereas we really didn't have a plan for what we did once we got there." Frank sometimes reminds me of a taxi driver who drives extremely fast and delivers you to the wrong address. And when you complain, says, "Well, at least I got you here fast."
Talking to Thomas Ricks of The Washington Post. His new book is Fiasco. And your book is being compared by many to David Halberstam's famous book about Vietnam, The Best and the Brightest. We're not necessarily talking about the best or the brightest here. We're talking about, nevertheless, certainly people that inspired a great deal of commanding force in the United States government and in the United States military, who were at least considered to be the best and the brightest again. Huh?
Yes, but there are huge similarities here to the Vietnam War, which Halberstam's book was about. In some ways, I think this is going to be worse than the Vietnam War, though. At the end of the Vietnam War, this nation could walk away and pretty much wash its hands of the situation, and it didn't have much effect on us. It was pretty bad if you were a Vietnamese ally of the United States or if you were Cambodian and suffered through a Holocaust. But for America, we could walk away. I don't think we can walk away from Iraq. As to the best and the brightest, yes, our generals tend to agree with that phrase, "We are the best and the brightest." There's not a lot of self-examination among many generals. There are some who stand out as exceptions, but broadly, their attitude was, "We're the best in the world." There's a lot of hubris. We're winners. You know, how could we possibly be doing things wrong here? So there was not an inclination to really critically and soberly look at the situation and look at their own actions and think about whether sometimes those actions were counterproductive. Good example is in the fall of 2003, when the insurgency started to rise and they decided to crack down on them, they conducted big cordon and sweep operations. And in certain areas, all military-age males were scarfed up, frequently humiliated in the course of the arrest, sandbags put over their head, and shipped off to Abu Ghraib or other prisons like that, kept there for 90 days, maybe eventually released. During those 90 days, they might have been abused by the yahoos at Abu Ghraib who were running the prison.
Of course, it wasn't only at Abu Ghraib, as you pointed
out. Yes, it was much more than that. And they were also held cheek by jowl with hardcore Al-Qaeda types. And this might be Avij Ahmed the Farmer. Well, when Avij Ahmed the Farmer went in, he was one guy. When he came out, he probably was a little less pro-American than when he went in. So that kind of big cordon sweep operation, I think, was counterproductive.
Along with keeping the Ba'athists out and essentially excluding them and so forth. I mean, it took a while for them to really figure out that this was not in the best interest of the United States.
Very much. And the other thing I think the generals were very slow to focus on was how ill-prepared U.S. troops were. And I don't just mean it in terms of equipment. I mean conceptually, training. What do you do? One example is the 1st Armored Division in Baghdad in the summer of 2003. A pretty good unit, by the way. Pretty well led. They had some soldiers who were supposed to stop looters. And they decided, these soldiers, that the best way to deter looters was to make them cry. Now, you will find this nowhere in Army training and doctrine or any classic counterinsurgency text to make them cry. But they decided that's what they'd do. So one day they caught a father and his two teenage sons looting. And they said to the father, "Which of your sons do you want us to shoot?" It's just a chilling thing to say.
It's like Sophie's Choice.
And the father said, as most fathers would, "No, please shoot me instead." They said, "No, you don't get to make that choice." And they took one of the sons around to the other side of a truck, and they fired a weapon past his head. And then they cried, and they turned them loose.
Great way to win goodwill, huh?
Well, they might have thought, they might have deterred those looters, but that's no way to win a war. Fundamentally, I think what most of all, the U.S. military didn't understand is the people were not the playing field in which you played against the enemy. The people were the prize. In a counterinsurgency, you need to win the people over, the fence sitters over. Instead, again and again, U.S. policies and U.S. tactics alienated that broad middle.
It's lack of self-examination, as you point out, lack of diplomacy or also failure of leadership. But also, the thing that looms here, perhaps, is these troops weren't trained, really.
Yes, and that's not taking care of the troops. And this takes me back to the issue with Congress. This is not just a matter of not informing the American people. It's a matter of not waging war effectively. When the military won't ask the tough questions, then the Congress should, and the Congress has not been.
Chris, the CIA warned Bremer against banning Ba'athists, for example. Right?
Yes, Bremer flew into Baghdad in the spring of 2003, determined to show there was a new sheriff in town. He was going to be bold and striking, and one of the things he was going to do was put a ban on anybody who'd been a fairly senior member of the Ba'athist party, Saddam Hussein's political party. And he showed this draft order he brought with him to the CIA station chief in Baghdad, who read it and looked it over and said, "You know, would you give me an hour to kind of redraft this?" Bremer said no. And he was asked again. Bremer said no. Finally, the CIA station chief gave up on the argument and said, "Look, you can issue this order as you've written it. But by nightfall, you will have driven 50,000 people underground. And 6 months from now, you're going to regret it." And it was one of those policies, along with dissolving the Iraqi military and the interior police, that took care of one of the basic problems for anybody trying to start an insurgency: recruiting. De-Ba'athification, which is very different, by the way, from what denazification was in post-war Germany, which is done in a much more studied way, beginning at the grassroots level. This was top-down, centralized de-Ba'athification issued from the top. And that gave the insurgency a lot of leaders, its cadre of leaders. And then the next order, which dissolved the military, solved the other problem of recruiting. Here's tens of thousands of angry, well-armed men.
Bremer and the military were at cross purposes?
Constantly. Military called the CPA, the Civilian Occupation Authority. They said it stood for can't provide anything. you'd be with officers who were working out in these dusty patrol bases way out in the desert or in the sort of jungly area between the rivers, and their eyes would get big when they went to the Green Zone. Some of them called it Oz. Green Zone was the U.S. Civilian headquarters in downtown Baghdad that became increasingly isolated as the insurgency began and as its front door was bombed and as they put blast balls up around it, and it became harder for them to get out. But it really had very little to do with what was happening in the rest of Iraq because it became so isolated. And officers in the military would say, these guys are totally cross purposes with this. We're trying to bring stability, and they keep on issuing orders that are destabilizing. You know, because the Green Zone and the civilian authority were full of a lot of ideologues, people who said, we have to make this country not only democracy, but a free market. One of Bremer's initiatives, by the way, was a flat tax. You know, long something that a lot of people on conservative politics in this country have wanted.
Steve Forbes, for years, yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to, at this point, I suspect a little bit, maybe too little too late, but the military is trying to show more respect for the people, to win their goodwill. I mean, there has been an effort to sort of resurrect that attitude.
Yeah, I don't want to be too negative. There are commanders who get it, especially guys who had some of their own education that weren't just relying on what the Army had trained and educated them to do. One example was Major General Dave Petraeus, has a PhD in international affairs from Princeton and had studied Vietnam and operated very well with the 101st Airborne Division in northern Iraq. Another example, also well-educated man, Colonel H.R. McMaster, commanded the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, and also wrote the book Dereliction of Duty about Vietnam.
You also mentioned Major Jim Gravelis.
Another smart guy out there in Arupa. I'd like to talk.
There were a few, though.
And also, their examples tended to be neglected. I was embedded with H.R. McMaster's 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment earlier this year up in Tal Afar in northwestern Iraq. And it's worth looking at a bit because it is the road not taken. McMaster took the 3rd ACR, which was a unit that had a mediocre first tour in Iraq. One Iraqi general who turned himself in to them was beaten to death in interrogation. There was an officer in the unit who carried a baseball bat. He called his Iraqi beater. McMaster took over that unit and went and looked every soldier in the eye, 3,500 of them, and said, every time you disrespect an Iraqi, you are working for the enemy. That's counterinsurgency doctrine, phrased in a way that any 21-year-old soldier can understand, grasp, and implement. Then McMaster went out to Iraq, and one of the first things he did was start a program called Ask the Customer. Who is the customer? Detainees. It's a very different way of looking at detainees. And all detainees in his unit upon release were asked, how were you treated? And his soldiers knew they'd be asked. And they had not one case of abuse in the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment's second tour in Iraq.
Yeah, but in the meantime, as we said earlier, in addition to Abu Ghraib, there was a kind of pervasive abuse going on. In fact, you mentioned the 4th Infantry, which is...
The 4th ID stood out especially. 4th Infantry Division was in the northern part of the Sunni Triangle up in Tikrit. I was up there in the summer of 03 briefly, and then I was also across the river with one of their brigades across the Tigris in July 2003. An interesting unit because the guy who commanded them, General Raymond Odierno, is going back later this year as the number 2 commander in Iraq in charge of day-to-day operations. And there's a general view among many of his peers that his unit was unnecessarily aggressive and abusive and helped fuel the insurgency through its actions.
Talking to Washington Post correspondent Tom Ricks, his new book is called Fiasco. He is a recipient of the Pulitzer Prize, and his book is really all about Iraq, how we got there, what we're doing there, and seems to be your opinion that we need to stay there, even though we've made so many mistakes.
I think it's an honorable position to talk about leaving as soon as possible. But I think if we are going to talk about that, we need to talk about the consequences of doing so. Would there be a civil war? Would there be a bloodbath across that country?
Forgive me, but we just got a note from the BBC that there was a memo sent out to Downing Street, to Tony Blair, and Middle East General John Abizaid says it's going to happen. Civil war is going to happen.
Well, I think it already has happened in the sense that I think we have a low-level civil war there right now. Every day, scores of people are being killed in that country in some form of civil war, civil violence. I think our unspoken mission there right now is to keep a lid on that civil war, to keep it from intensifying. A full-blown civil war, I think, would be far bloodier and uglier than what you have there now. And look, it is possible for Iraq to get worse. Every time I've been there, 5 times over the last 3 years, I've been stunned at how bad it is. And every time I've gone back, it's been worse the next time. So it can get much worse. We maybe look back on this and say, man, that was just Act 3 in a 5-act tragedy. You know, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern were still alive back then. It could get very tough over there. If you had a full-blown civil war, I think, first of all, this country would be blamed by many people around the world for it occurring. Second, it could easily spill over the borders of that country and pull in Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, and even Turkey, a NATO ally. If the Kurds made a bid for independence, as they likely would in a civil war, the Turks likely would invade the north. Then we have a NATO country involved. It could get extremely messy extremely quickly.
So we need to stay there as an occupying force?
My personal opinion is, yes, if we can, that's probably the best-case scenario. To what strategists in Iraq told me, U.S. military guys, was you probably want to radically change your posture. You don't want to stay the course because it's not politically sustainable either here or in Iraq. But what you could do is probably cut your force structure by about 2/3, get down to about 50,000 troops, and take the $1.5 billion a week we're spending there now and dedicate it much more to the training and advisory program. Make those Iraqis who are allied with us look like winners and put in the best and the brightest in our force, the future generals, to go and be the advisors rather than use a pickup team for advisors.
We're going to be cutting soldiers before November because of the election. So that's almost foregone conclusion, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, this was supposed to be the year of the cuts. Everybody in the Army assumed we'd be down to 100,000 troops by the end of this year. But we're more than halfway through this year, and the troop numbers are increasing, not decreasing. It's been bouncing between 127 and 138 for many, many months now. So the Army has long wanted and planned to cut the force there, and it just never seems to happen.
We'll see how Senator Lieberman does on Tuesday. That may have at least some contribution to the whole picture. But you've talked about a worse outcome than the Civil War, and that would be an anti-U.S. tyrant, and that could happen too.
Yeah, I worry that if we keep messing this up as badly as we have, that eventually Iraqis will just get sick of it. It is a terrible thing to be living in Baghdad now day to day. It's just terrifying. I was out in a part of the city because it's a myth that reporters live in the green zone, by the way. We had a house out in the red zone where I stayed. And one day I was sitting there writing a story most of the day, and my bureau chief, a very tough woman named Ellen Nickmeyer, came in. And I said, hey, Ellen, while I'm sitting here today just writing my story, I've heard 2 explosions and a couple of 100 rounds of fire. And she said, yeah, quiet day. The U.S. military tends not to see that. I later looked through the classified database for the neighborhood I live in. A friendly officer just let me look through all the intelligence information. They had none of that information in their database. They said, that area is secure, sir. And I said, what do you mean? I'm hearing lots of stuff out there. So they said, no, it's secure. It's rated green. What I realized is what the U.S. military looks at as two things. Any threat to American troops and any killing of Iraqis. What does that leave out? Well, probably about half of what goes on. Rapes, robberies, and mainly intimidation. And the pervasive sense of no security. So they really, I think, don't have an accurate picture in the military of what's happening out in that big world out there. Iraqis will get sick of that, I think, eventually, and just say, look, let's just get somebody to pull this country together. Let's find a new Saddam.
Somebody who could be worse than Saddam.
Yeah, a young, vigorous Saddam who harnesses that oil money, buys himself a couple of nukes, and decides to knock Tel Aviv, New York, and Washington off the map.
Talking again with Tom Ricks, and we welcome your calls. If you'd like to join us, you can do that now toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number for your calls, 866-733-6786, or join us by email. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Tom Ricks, who is correspondent for The Washington Post, senior Pentagon correspondent, and also the author of Making the Corps and A Soldier's Duty. His new book, all about the Iraq invasion and the occupation, is called Fiasco, and it's subtitled The American Military Adventure in Iraq. He's a recipient of the Pulitzer Prize, and you can join us here if you have something you'd like to contribute. We certainly welcome your phone calls, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Feel free to join us anytime in the half hour more that we have or so with Tom Ricks. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or you can send us an email if you have a question or a comment. The email address is forum, F-O-R-U-M, at kqed.org. First caller up, Ron, that's you. Good morning.
Hi. When General Shinseki said that we'd need about twice as many troops in Iraq as we currently as were sent, he must have known, I guess, that we had that number of troops available, at least for a short amount of time. To have that amount of troops for a much longer period of time, do you think that maybe we needed to, say, increase the size of the armed forces overall?
Yes, I do. One of the limiting factors on the troop numbers in Iraq has been simply that there aren't troops on the shelf. As a Pentagon official said to me recently, we're out of Schlitz. And this is a problem not only for Iraq, it's a problem for the rest of the world, because any adversary elsewhere, North Korea, for example, might say the Americans are tied down in Iraq and now's the time to act.
Thank you for the call, and we're going to move along and take more of your calls here, and we'll go next to Marin. Andrew, hi.
Hello, thank you. There's several things I'd like to say, as I've heard you speak often, Mr. Hicks. But one of them, the point is that I advocated around 2002 that this administration, in fact, is looking at shaping Iraq like a Central American country. And Dick Cheney even pointed that out in one of his debates with Vice President Professor Edwards. But my question is, given the circumstances, you had 9/11 happen, so the country was in a panic. You had an administration of a small body of people who were envisioning destroying the infrastructure of Iraq, letting it run free. Free market and capitalism would then create the country that they wanted with their military there to back it up. How do you envision the military going to their commander-in-chief and saying, no, we won't do it. We're not, you give us something or we won't do it at all. Or how would you expect, I'm just being fair, how would you expect a Congress and a Senate that is run by that president's party to say, sir, this is crazy. We're not going to do this. You may be the leader of our party, but what you're promoting looks like it'll be an abject failure and lead this country down the path of ruin. How would they be able to do that and survive? So the small body of people have, in fact, manipulated the situation to create a scenario that they indeed envisioned would be beneficial to everyone, but in fact wasn't. But through that process, they broke all the rules.
Yeah, Andrew, let's get some report. And again, you're raising a question of accountability here. Get Tom Ricks to respond to you.
You put your finger on a good problem, which is, the Congress felt it had no incentive to carry out its constitutional role. The Republicans didn't want to cross a president of their own party, and the Democrats didn't seem to know how to do it.
Also, plus, they were very fearful, of course, that they would be looked at as weak.
That's right. There's a narrowness in the way that this country went to war, a narrowing of support that was really striking in the Bush administration and kind of emerged. I noticed this pattern in reporting out how we went to war. People who were inside the government who offered different information, were skeptical, expressed doubts, were not invited back to the next meeting. That extended even to Congress. For example, in my book, I talk about Representative Ike Skelton, a conservative Missouri Democrat, pro-defense type, a guy who would be a natural ally of the administration. When he sent a letter to President Bush expressing some very insightful doubts and concerns about the difficulty of occupation, the response he got from a White House aide was, Mr. Congressman, we don't need your vote. Contrast that to FDR at the outset of World War II, bringing in a Republican, Henry Stimson, to be his Secretary of War. Usually, if you want the nation to go to war, you try to bring the nation together to go to war. Instead, I think this war has been prosecuted in a very partisan manner, in which loyal dissent, honest dissent, and criticism has been slapped down and called unpatriotic.
You learn from those who are in opposition to you or who have serious doubts or skepticism. Doris Kearns Goodwin, you know, fine historian, wrote a book about Lincoln's closest circle, and so many of them were arguing with him all the time during the Civil War and even before the Civil War and so forth, but he was able to integrate that into policy. This is something this administration hasn't done.
Lincoln's greatness, I think, was his ability to even humiliate himself to do the right thing. So he brought in Stanton, a man who really had humiliated him as a lawyer, kicked him off a major case, essentially. He brought him in because he thought he'd be the best guy for the job.
Well, we'll go to more of your calls, and we welcome Mike from San Jose. Good morning. Mike, are you there?
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thanks for the topic and for the guest for his work. My question has to do with the non-U.S. Army troops that are there, the contractors, both the numbers and the roles they're playing and the possible influence on the insurgency.
That's a very good question, and I think this is one of the things that future historians will look back on as one of the unique characteristics of this war, which is the reliance on so-called private sector contractors, which are essentially mercenaries. I think it's really had a polluting effect on the battlefield. They are well-armed. They are inclined to shoot. They are not subject to military discipline or to the military chain of command. It's not clear what law they're subject to. And their mission is not to help the U.S. win. It's to do whatever job they've been assigned. So, for example, if you're a bodyguard for a VIP, your job is to keep that guy alive. And you might do that by shooting at Iraqis or by driving on Baghdad sidewalks, which they do frequently. That'll antagonize Iraqis. I remember one colonel saying to me, we have 100 of these missions on the streets of Baghdad every day. You figure each mission goes out and alienates about 100 people. He said, that's 10,000 people a day we're alienating simply through our VIP bodyguard service.
Yeah, talk about all the alienation of Iraqis. Part of this, I think, not only stems from all of the facts that we're talking about with the occupation and with lack of concern about Iraqi citizens and all that, looking at them as people have to be won over and so forth. But there was also a tremendous kind of inflated expectation among the Iraqis. The Americans would come in, they would give us electricity, they would give us all these things that, you know, they had bountiful riches, so they would provide for us. And, of course, that was never met in any measurable way. And, in fact, they wound up without electricity and so forth.
Yeah, and there's a lot of worry among smart officers in Iraq that we really had 6 months to get it right. And after 6 months, we essentially had lost any prospect of winning the Iraqis over to us. And these are the guys who are arguing, look, let's just get out of here. This ain't going to work. And we're simply in a deep hole and just digging harder, thinking we'll get ourselves out that way. I want to emphasize something that has really surprised me in the response to this book over the last couple of weeks since it came out. As of today, I have not had a single negative email, a single negative response from any U.S. soldier in Iraq. And I've had many positive ones. My favorite one was from a battalion commander who wrote to me, I'm glad finally somebody's saying publicly what we all have been saying privately for the last 2 years.
A battalion commander, yeah. You know, one of the things I couldn't help focusing on in reading your book was how these caches of weapons were just completely left unguarded.
Well, I mean, that's,
again, making it so much easier, contributing to the insurgency in ways that...
That's, you know, step two in creating an insurgency. We talked about step one, recruiting. Step two, arming. One of the classic problems for insurgency is getting weapons in. Typically, they have to be smuggled in, and then you can go after the smugglers, and you can follow the smuggling networks and find the leadership. No, we didn't want the Iraqi insurgency to have that problem. We didn't have enough soldiers to guard these huge weapons dumps. And we had dissolved the Iraqi military, which probably with some leakage could have also guarded those dumps. We left those dumps totally unguarded, and anybody who needed some weapons could just walk down and get them. We didn't even blow up the dumps because our military had been told that there were going to be weapons of mass destruction. I asked one battalion commander, why didn't you blow up the dumps as you passed them? He said, sir, we thought there might be chemicals in there. I don't want to be the guy who sets up the plume of chemical weapons that takes out 10,000 Iraqis. So our false information about WMDs was one of the factors that helped create the insurgency. This is how mistakes can bite you again and again and again if you don't admit to them and address them and adjust.
WMDs may have gotten us in and kept the thing going, as you're suggesting. Also, the Syrian border was left wide open.
Exactly, and that's step three in creating an insurgency. The third thing you need after recruiting and arming is financing. One of the classic things they say in counterinsurgency doctrine is close the borders. We didn't have enough troops to close the borders. We didn't seal the borders. And so people could go back and forth into Syria. Ba'athist leaders, keep a house there, keep a villa there, keep your gold, your documents, and bring in the financing when you needed it.
Some think there may be even some WMDs over Syria, but you are not one of those, I presume.
Well, there was overhead satellite imagery just before the war and at the beginning of the war that showed a lot of trucks going up to Syria. And there are still some true believers, I think of them as the flat earthers, who think that was WMD being trucked up there. I think the evidence is no. It was valuables, cash, and documents that became the third essential building block of the insurgency.
Go to more of your calls in a minute. Let me go to some emails, though. Here's somebody from Berkeley who says, Brad DeLong complains that your reporting during the war did not point out that administration officials were saying things that were not true. Let's not say they lied. In particular, a report about Mr. Wolfowitz's testimony before Congress. How do you justify this?
I'm a reporter. One of the parts of being the job of being a reporter is to accurately report what people say. It doesn't mean I agree with it. One of the things, in fact, that you do as a reporter, sometimes somebody will say something, and you say, I can't believe he said that. I'm going to write a story about that just to get that on the record in the paper.
A number of other emails I'll just go to here. Here's a question from Robert. Why do you think we went into Iraq? Oil? Freedom? Why? WMDs?
There was a small group of people, most notably Paul Wolfowitz, who had long wanted to change the regime in Iraq, but I think a disparate of actually getting a U.S. invasion to do it, thought you'd have to do it with Iraqi exiles, perhaps supported by U.S. air power. I do think that changed with 9/11. The Bush administration, I think privately realizing it had really been taken by surprise, it ignored important information and been caught with its pants around its knees, decided we're not going to get surprised again. But even that really doesn't explain wholly why go to Iraq. If you really are focused on the war on terror, why not do what the number two officer in the U.S. Army, Jack Keane, recommended at the time? He said, don't invade Iraq. Put two divisions on the Afghan-Pakistani border and catch Osama bin Laden. I think that what happened was they talked themselves into it. People say Bush lied. I think it's in some ways scarier than that. I think they deceived themselves.
They lied to themselves, yeah.
Yeah, and so there was no new evidence on weapons of mass destruction emerging after 1998 when the Desert Fox operation, the raids in 1998, shut down the last parts of the Iraqi programs. Yet, despite that lack of new evidence, the Bush administration persuaded itself that Iraq was a threat. What we know now, because the U.S. interrogated Iraqi weapons scientists, was that there was no threat. And, in fact, not only was Saddam Hussein not a clear and present danger, he wasn't even the biggest threat in the neighborhood. Iran probably was a bigger threat and remains a bigger threat.
Brings up another question from one of our listeners who asked, do you think the Bush administration is planning some sort of military operation aimed at changing the regime in Iran? Speculate on the possible consequences of such madness, and thank you for your great work.
Thank you. There's a lot of talk about it. I don't think it's going to happen, but look, Sam Goldwyn said never make predictions, especially about the future. I've been surprised by this administration before.
Here's Michael from Mill Valley. I'm surprised that you still support the occupation, he writes. Wouldn't the withdrawal of occupation forces remove the central element preventing the various Iraqi forces from sitting down to talk? It doesn't seem to me that the cause of the problem, U.S. military, can also be the solution. And the facts on the ground seem to indicate that, too.
I don't think Iraqi factions want to talk to each other at this point. They want to kill each other. And they are killing each other on a daily basis. And it's not an easy situation. I don't really consider myself a supporter of the occupation. I'm just trying to point out that the alternatives aren't real appetizing either.
Dan from Redwood City writes, one of the biggest mistakes in the occupation was not recalling the Iraqi army to provide security after the invasion. In Paul Bremer's book, he says that he told the Defense Department he was going to do that, and they didn't object. Has Mr. Ricks had any insight on the decision-making process inside the Defense Department that approved this decision? Was there a serious discussion of the possibility of a security meltdown?
I don't think there was a serious discussion of the consequences of dissolving the Iraqi military. And I know a lot of people in the U.S. military opposed it and had thought something different was going to happen. I've seen the official planning. The planning was to retain the Iraqi army and to use it to help with reconstruction and so on. Another hidden problem here that I hadn't really focused on until recently was we had been leafleting the Iraqi army from the air for years, telling them, if the Americans invade, do not fight us, and we will take care of you. And then once we were in Baghdad, we said, get lost.
I think we would have learned the lesson from Afghanistan. Chuck, you're on. Hi.
A lot. It seems to me that the reason behind the invasion was that it's part of the Bush administration's forward strategy of freedom in the Middle East to try and transform it into a democratic, free region.
I think that's right. It was they were about draining the swamp, fundamentally.
Yeah. So the WMD was just kind of a pretext. But I guess I agree with you that not that anyone cares whether I agree with you, but that we got to fix this. What scares me is the people that made this mess are in leadership positions for years to come, and I'm not sure how the ones who made the mess are going to fix it. But it seems to me that everyone seems to be talking about the step to getting this thing fixed is to transfer security responsibilities to the Iraqis. It seems to me, unless it's going to just be kind of a basically a Shiite army kind of trying to keep an insurgency in check, that's really not going to work. That seems like a very unattractive option. It seems like what it's going to have to be is an integrated military that kind of can have control over the country with the consent of the population for the most part. So it's got Shiites and Sunnis, and that rather presupposes that you've kind of solved the base problem already, and that kind of eliminates the need for the security forces. So basically my question is, don't you see the real answer here as being one of building democratic institutions so that you can get like a constitution that brings all the various factions into a government together and builds political parties and political leaders and
well, Chuck, there is that constitution. That constitution is already there.
Well, there is a constitution,
right.
But I'm not sure it's the constitution that's going to work. So basically what I'm saying is it seems to me just the idea of transferring the responsibilities for security to Iraqi forces as opposed to American forces doesn't solve the problem. The real solution is a political one that involves building democratic institutions. How has that problem been addressed up to this point, and do you see any way to do it better?
I think that's an extremely good political analysis. I wish I'd said it. You point to the circular problem here. You can never have a military solution. It's fundamentally a political problem. But where you want security institutions, minimally, if for nothing else, is to keep alive your politicians and your government. Right now, it's an extremely dangerous thing to be an Iraqi politician. Whether you're Sunni or Shiite, somebody's out to kill you. So you do need to keep them alive. You do need to keep the government up and running. It's not clear to me how far the writ of the Iraqi government extends beyond the high walls of the Green Zone.
I think Chuck is right, too, about the need for a strong infrastructure and a security. I mean, we've heard this from the beginning, but, for example, there's an article in today's New York Times about how you can't tell. Sorry, I know it's a rival paper, but you can't really tell who is on which side by a uniform anymore.
Yeah, it's something that always worried me, stopping at checkpoints in Iraq. You see these guys in uniforms, and, are they criminals in uniforms? Are they militias in uniforms? Are they corrupt guys who simply are going to whack me? I remember mentioning this once to an American general, and he looked at me in shock and said, "You stop at checkpoints?" I said, "Well, yeah, I'm a civilian, and I don't have a helicopter to fly over them." But this is, I think, the key question as I look at the training effort, and I think nobody knows what the answer is. Are we training the Iraqis to support a government, or are we training them so they can fight a good civil war?
It seems to me that I hope it's not the latter, but I fear it is, and the only way it's not going to be is if there's a government to support, and I really don't see that much is being done in the way of accomplishing that, which is to say, we've transferred sovereignty to Iraqis, which is to say people with Iraqi names.
Yeah, but talking and talking is not necessarily going to solve the problem for this reason. There is a fundamentally irreconcilable question here between the two sides. The Shiites look at Iraq and say, we're a majority in this country, we should be running it. The Sunnis look at the country and say, we're a majority in this region, and if you try to run it, we have power in the region. From such irreconcilable differences, democratic politics are rarely born. More often, they result in wars.
Plus, aside from the Shiites being the majority, the Sunnis had been in power for so long under Saddam.
And under the Turks.
I mean, they'd had hegemony going way back, and consequently, they're not necessarily willing to exactly cede that over to the Shiites, and one can understand that. Let me go to more of your calls, though. Armin from San Jose. Morning.
Hi. Love your show. My question is very simple. As a political science student that's been following the situation and the debate from the beginning, You mentioned accountability on Congress, and my question is this. A lot of people since the beginning have been calling the Democrats, I guess, gutless for not doing more and not debating more. But my question is, could they really have done much? Because when you look at Congress, when you look at the Senate, when you look at the House with the majorities that the Republicans have, is there anything they could have done? Could they have gone out there and done studies? Could they have gone out there and done investigations? Or would those have been stopped by the Republicans?
That's a good question. It's very difficult to be in the minority, especially if you look at today's Democrats, who are not accustomed to being in the minority and frequently act if it's all a bad dream that will go away soon. They haven't learned how to be the minority. It's especially difficult when you don't have the executive branch on your side. Frequently, Republicans used to be in the minority in Congress but had the executive. They really are kind of wandering in the wilderness. That said, it's possible to be far more effective. You can conduct independent inquiries. You can put out reports. You can independently gather information. That's essentially what I did with this book. I got 37,000 pages of documents, and I read them, and I looked at the patterns that emerged. And they were surprising to me, a lot of them. I've covered the military for a long time. You don't cover it as long as I have, 17 years, unless you like being around the military. But I went in, and I was really shocked by some of the things I found, like the pervasiveness of abuse in 2003, 2004. And I tried to ask questions about it and figure out what happened. And you can have a congressional staffer go and do that, probably far more effective, because the Pentagon really didn't want to talk to me for my book. But they'll have to give Congress some information.
Let me thank the caller and move along to more of your calls. And we go next to Roger. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yes, thank you. You know, I think the major problem here is the American people themselves. We selected a conservative government. We selected the neocons. Israel has the same problem. They selected the Likud. Those people have one answer for world problems, and that is utilizing the military. They think they can shoot their way out of problems. It is not possible. We are fighting an ideology, whether it's in Iraq or in Lebanon. You can't beat that way. You can beat it with intelligent diplomacy. You can defeat it by really observing your own society and seeing how it's being manipulated. If we're ever going to get ahead of this situation, and we better hurry up and get ahead of this situation, because like Hezbollah, they believe that they're succeeding. The whole Arab world is beginning to look at this group as a successful military operation. And they're going to find the same answer as our neocons did, that they can probably shoot their way out of this problem. It won't be long before they develop nuclear weapons.
Roger, let me take your initial premise, if I may. What do you think, Tom Ricks, about the idea that the people are culpable?
I do think the American people do need to look in the mirror and say, how did we get to this situation? There's a song out on a new album by Josh Ritter, a young, good singer, that I listened to a lot when I was finishing this book, and it really captures, I think, the American mood. The refrain of the song is, what is it that we've done? It's about Iraq. What have we done here? And I think we're still grappling with that.
What are we doing?
It's funny. I don't think, you don't see people marching in the streets, but I do think that there is a broad frustration and anxiety with what we're doing out there that runs much broader and deeper than during the Vietnam War, when you had a smaller vocal minority but still majority support for the war pretty late in the war.
We also had conscription, which made for the marching in the streets to a greater degree.
But one other thing that Roger said that I think is important, which is about diplomacy and trying to shoot your way out of problems. One thing that strikes me about Iraq is the opportunity cost there. We're spending $1.5 billion a week there, more than $200 million a day there. Think if you took 1 week of spending in Iraq and you spent it instead on schools in Pakistan that taught tolerance, democracy, and in a Pakistani context, helped educate these kids.
This is one of the things that's running that Lamont campaign in Connecticut. I mean, the idea that the money would be better spent. And well, here's a question from one of our listeners, Robert, who says, who's accountable for the selection of Franks and Sanchez?
Franks was really proposed by Anthony Zinni, who was his predecessor at Central Command. Which surprises me, because Zinni is a very bright man and a good strategist, and I don't think that Franks has shown either of those qualities particularly. Sanchez was an even stranger pick. Here he was, the most junior lieutenant general in the Army, had never commanded anything bigger than a division of, say, 15,000 troops, and suddenly he's commanding 150,000 people. He's not given the staff. They put him in a terrible position. This is a genuinely, I think, stirringly good story of a guy who rose from deep poverty, you know, along the Rio Grande Valley to become a senior general in the Army, but I think nonetheless was not equipped for the job.
Let's try to get another call in here. Nicholas, that's you. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to comment, this is, I think, one problem among many problems, but the problem with the divisive character of the proportional representation system of elections that they had. I read recently a book by Professor Ferdinand Hermans that analyzed the Weimar Republic and various other experiments with proportional representation. And he said, you know, over decades, he was a professor of political science at Notre Dame, he said it magnifies divisions. It makes it almost impossible for the parties that result from those divisions to end up working together. And what I see in Iraq is sort of a replay of what happened in various countries, including the Weimar Republic turning into Nazi Germany back in the 30s.
I think that's a fair point, Tom Ricks. Yeah.
It is a very good point. It's something I've heard a lot in Baghdad, that it was a mistake to go to elections so quickly for precisely that reason, is that, as Yates said, the center cannot hold, and the worst are full of passionate intensity, and the best lack all conviction. The glue of democracy is the middle class, the professionals, the lawyers, the doctors, and the journalists, and so on. They are fleeing Iraq right now. So what you have is a democracy of the hard men, democracy for coming out of the barrel of a gun.
Tom Ricks, I'll say it for many of us here. Thank you for your work. Thank you for being with us. Appreciate it very much. Tom Ricks, again, is senior Pentagon correspondent with The Washington Post, and his book is called Fiasco. Glad to be with you here every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory, and Laura Mall. Our interns are Jessica Dell, Sophie Lynette, J.M. Mather, Erica Reeder, Sarah Skickney, and Sage Van Wing. Forum's engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.